tinyurl.com/AsadaLA. Asada is spelled A-S-S-A-T-A. Again, that's tinyurl.com/AsadaLA.
In the spirit of Asada Shakur, we make this movement towards freedom for all those who have been oppressed and all those in the struggle. Yeah, yeah, check it.
90.7 FM, KPFK, Los Angeles.
Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with more questions arising about Trump's mental health following his surprise announcement that the U.S. would resume nuclear testing, which he based upon dangerously deficient evidence and deep ignorance, particularly when you consider that Trump has at his fingertips the power to destroy the world in 30 minutes. Joining us is Joseph Cerincione, Vice Chair of the Board of the Center for International Policy and a national security analyst and author with over 35 years of experience working in Washington, D.C. He's the author and editor of 7 books, including Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late, and Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously served as president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation, and director for nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, among other positions. He also worked for over 9 years on the professional staff of the Armed Services Committee and the Government Operations Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives. He writes the Substack page Strategy and History, where his latest article is Donald Trump's Deep Nuclear Confusion. Then we'll look into how the top priority for dictators is to close down their legislature, which Hitler did in 1933 using the Reichstag fire as an excuse. But Trump needs no such false flag operation. He has Speaker Mike Johnson closing down the Congress for him with the House of Representatives that has only convened for 12 days in the last 3 months and appears ready to shut down indefinitely so that their dear leader can rule by decree. Joining us is Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of several books, including The Byrne Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. He has won numerous journalism awards and shared the Pulitzer Prize, and we'll discuss his latest articles at the Philadelphia Inquirer, How a Nice Shakeup Will Bring Chicago-Level Terror to Philly, and It Didn't Take a Reichstag Fire to Burn Down Congress. Then finally, we'll speak with Fatima Jamalpour, who is a feminist journalist banned from working in Iran by the Ministry of Intelligence. Jamalpour has worked as a freelance reporter for outlets such as the Sunday Times, the Paris Review, and the Los Angeles Times, and has held positions at the BBC World News in London and at the Shag newspaper in Tehran. She has 2 master's degrees in journalism and communications from Northwestern University and Alamat Debatabai University in Tehran, and was a 2024-25 Knight Wallace Fellow at the University of Michigan. We will discuss her latest book, which she co-authored with journalist Nilo Tabrizi, For the Sun After Long Nights, released on the 3-year anniversary of the Women Life Freedom Movement in Iran, following the death of Mahsa Jina Amini at the hands of the morality police in Tehran. And joining us now is Joe Cerincione, the Vice Chair of the Board for the Center for International Policy and a national security analyst and author with over 35 years of experience working in Washington, D.C. He's the author or editor of 7 books, including Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late, and Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously served as president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation, and was also the director for nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, among other positions. He also worked for over 9 years on the professional staff of the Armed Services Committee and the Government Operations Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives. And he writes the Substack page Strategy and History, where his latest article is Donald Trump's Deep Nuclear Confusion. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cerincione.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you very much for having me.
So, Joe, speaking of nuclear confusion, just before Trump met with Xi Jinping last week in Seoul, it wasn't in Seoul, but at a military base in South Korea, he suddenly made this announcement on Thursday. Quote, because of other countries' testing programs, I have instructed the Department of War to start testing our nuclear weapons on an equal basis. Well, there's a couple of problems with that. Is one, no other countries are testing nuclear weapons except North Korea. Two, the Department of War, or the Department of Defense, doesn't test nuclear weapons. The Department of Energy does. And I could go on. So what's going on?
Yeah. Well, Ian, we've gotten used to Donald Trump's lying. He lies like other people breathe. And when he says things like Mexico will pay for the wall, or I won the 2020 election, or I'm not going to touch the East Wing, that's a certain level of obvious lying that we understand. We can all see that. But now he's talking about nuclear weapons. He's discussing the most destructive weapons humankind has ever invented, and he has sole authority to use them whenever he wants, for whatever reason he wants. So it's deeply disturbing that he's making statements like this. Almost everything he said about it, as you just pointed out, was completely wrong. Other countries are not testing nuclear weapons. No other country has tested nuclear weapons for 30 years, except for North Korea, which tested a few weapons in the last decade. And it's one of the reasons we consider them a rogue nation outside of international norms. So he says the Department of War should start the testing our nuclear weapons immediately. The Department of War does not test our nuclear weapons. The Department of Energy does. And there is no immediately. We closed down the Nevada nuclear test site starting in 1992, which is when we stopped testing because we had conducted over 1,000 tests, more than all the other countries in the world combined. We had all the data we needed to ensure the safety, reliability, and effectiveness of our nuclear weapons henceforth. We do not need to test. It would take at least 18 months to 36 months to reopen that facility. So there is no immediately here. So what's going on here? There's several possibilities. One, and the most likely in my view, is that this was just a boss move, kind of a flex before he's getting set to meet President Xi of China. He just wants to show he's tough. He wants to, you know, accumulate some chips for his negotiations. The second is that he really is deeply confused, that he doesn't understand what's going on, and he's reacting to Russia's tests last week of a long-range cruise missile and a long-range underwater drone. And he might consider that nuclear testing. But those didn't have nuclear warheads. They're testing the delivery vehicle, not the weapon itself. That's also a very real possibility. He just doesn't know what he's talking about. And the third possibility is that some of the hardline conservatives in the Pentagon, and particularly associated with the Heritage Foundation, have gotten to him. These nuclear hawks have wanted to restart nuclear testing for years. They never wanted to stop it in the first place. It's part of the Project 2025 agenda to begin testing nuclear weapons again. So they may have gotten to him in some way, and he's advancing that agenda. We just don't know because he doesn't explain what he's saying. He makes these comments offhand on a social media post, doesn't explain what he means. And then his comments to reporters on the plane also don't illuminate what he's talking about. They just add to the confusion, add to the misinformation. So it should be deeply troubling to all of us that we have a president of the United States that is so deeply ignorant, so deeply confused that he could be starting a new nuclear arms race and not even realize what he's done.
Well, he is a reality TV guy. That's all he knows. And this is a reality TV technique. You always leave each episode with a cliffhanger, right?
Well, that's right. It could be just entertainment value.
Right. Well, in the mid-80s, I worked as a consultant to Los Alamos for a couple of years. So I'm pretty familiar with what nuclear testing's about. And the U.S. has conducted 1,054 nuclear tests beginning in the first atomic bomb in 1945. And they stopped testing in 1992. And frankly, over 1,000 explosive tests, it's not really science. It's engineering at best. You just don't need to know anything more about nuclear weapons.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And we, with all the data we've collected, we now have a deep scientific understanding of the nuclear explosive process, starting with the creation of this very hot super plasma in the first microseconds of a blast. We've taken that data because we instrument all our tests. We're not just popping them off to see the mushroom cloud. Or in for since 1960s, all our tests have been underground, as have everybody else's tests in the world. We're not just popping these off to see the explosion or make the Earth tremble. We're collecting the data. We instrument it. We've collected that data and we've hooked it up to our supercomputers, and we now model nuclear explosions. So we're the best in the world at this. So we have everything we need to make sure that our existing nuclear weapons are safe and reliable. Maybe you heard Vice President Vance say that every once in a while you have to test to make sure they work. No. He had to retract that statement because, no, we know they work. They'll go off when they're supposed to. They won't go off when they're not supposed to. And if we actually restart nuclear testing, what that's going to mean is that other countries will follow suit. The Russians have already said, if we start, then they will start. If they start, China will certainly test. They've only conducted 45 nuclear tests. They would love the chance to get more data to develop new weapons. India, Pakistan would likely follow suit, and others. Israel has only conducted one test, as far as we know, and they may want to test as well. So that's the danger. And that means that they will start to catch up with the American knowledge. By restarting testing, we're actually weakening America. We're giving up our advantage in nuclear scientific knowledge. We're allowing other countries to develop weapons they cannot now develop.
And the Israeli test was back during the Carter administration off what's now called Namibia in the ocean. And that was a nuclear trigger for a thermonuclear device, or also is actually a neutron bomb as well. So their arsenal is largely thermonuclear. And the reason that you develop thermonuclear weapons is not because they have a bigger bang, which they certainly do by a huge factor, is because you can miniaturize them and therefore have more explosives in a smaller in a smaller package. So Israel has a pretty advanced arsenal. China has about 600 nuclear weapons, as you mentioned. They've only carried out 45 tests. Their first test was in 1964, and their last was in 1996. And the US gave up in 92,
right.
Russia in 94, I think, China in 96. So it's been a while. Now, I understand that this possibly could be being driven by Project 2025, which Trump is following to the letter. And Russ Vought, one of the architects of Project 2025, seems to be running the show along with Stephen Miller, the co-president, while Trump watches television and does photo ops. So I wouldn't discount the influence of Project 2025. And my understanding is, Joe, they not only want to resume nuclear testing, they actually want to resume atmospheric nuclear testing.
That's exactly right. Because, as I mentioned, it would take at least 18 to 36 months to reopen the Nevada test site. One of the Heritage Foundation experts posted just the other day, if it's going to take that long, we should just do an atmospheric test. Now, you have to understand, the entire world was horrified at the radiation poisoning that atmospheric tests, mostly ours, but also the Soviets, were spewing out in the 1950s. And that international reaction, radioactive isotopes started showing up in cow's milk, in mother's milk, in our food crops, that led the US and the Soviet Union, when President Kennedy was in office, to negotiate what they called the Limited Test Ban Treaty back in 1962, ending atmospheric tests. Now, we did that, and so we ended the most tests. Soviets had the second most tests. They stopped. A couple of countries, China, France, kept testing in the atmosphere, but by the end of the 60s, they stopped doing that as well. And there hasn't been an atmospheric test. Nobody's seen a mushroom cloud for almost, over 50 years. And that's what the Heritage Foundation is talking about doing again. They want to have Donald Trump make nuclear testing great again. They want to go back to the heyday of uncontrolled testing, uncontrolled production of nuclear weapons. It's a nightmare world that we barely escaped, and they want to drag us back into it.
But underground testing is incredibly expensive. I mean, you've got to dig those tunnels. My understanding is it's about $200 million. That's right.
That's exactly right. This is not cheap.
Yeah, just to pop one off. $200 million. I mean, here we are shutting down 42 million Americans are poised to lose their food stamps to go hungry, and you're wasting that kind of money, even if they go ahead.
Right. We don't have money for food stamps. We don't have money for health care, but we have money for a golden ballroom in the West White House. We have money for marble toilets in the Lincoln bedroom. Maybe you saw his posting of that beautiful architectural project over the weekend. And we have money for unlimited money for spending on nuclear weapons. What is wrong with our priorities?
Well, is there a chance then that this could be stopped? Obviously, there's so much that has to be stopped.
Yes,
not the least of which is the golden ballroom, and of course, then you've also got the golden dome, which we haven't even talked about, which is this massive new boondoggle that Trump has launched, and all of these Silicon Valley bros that have funded him, including Elon Musk, are getting in on the act and say we're going to have a tech industrial complex along with a military industrial complex.
Yeah. Right. I mean, let's take those two in reverse order. You can see that Donald Trump's Golden Dome, that is an effort to recreate and to resurrect as the Star Wars program that Ronald Reagan started, that we have spent $453 million on and have nothing to show for it. We tried every project we could imagine: space-based lasers, ground-based lasers, particle beam weapons, space-based interceptors, ground-based. Nothing worked. All we have to show for that is 44 interceptors in Alaska and parts of California that work some of the time. In tests, under ideal conditions, they hit the target about half the time. And there's also deep technological flaws in those interceptors, so bad that the Pentagon itself has canceled the program and is trying to develop a new, what they call next generation interceptor. So completely unreliable system. If anyone's seen A House of Dynamite, the central actor in that Netflix movie, which by the way, is now the number one streaming movie in the world, the central actor is those ground-based interceptors in Alaska, which Catherine Bigelow, the director, depicts very accurately. And spoiler alert, they miss the target. They miss the target they're aiming at, and a warhead starts plummeting towards the United States. That's an accurate depiction of the state of affairs. Nothing Donald Trump is going to do with Golden Dome is going to change the technical scientific reality that a reliable defense that can protect the nation is just technologically impossible. Going back to whether we can stop any of this, I think, unfortunately, since the Congress has become just a rubber stamp of Donald Trump, we're going to continue to allocate tens of billions of dollars a year towards this program, whether it works or not. Contractors like Lockheed Martin are urging us to go faster. They want to bid on the production of these new interceptors. They're calling for a Manhattan project for the Golden Dome to get it up in a year, a ridiculous claim, can't do that. But you see that kind of contractor frenzy chasing the dollars. Fortunately, there are more sensible people in Congress, and you've seen an immediate congressional reaction against the resumption of nuclear testing, even including some Republicans who are trying to sort of walk Donald Trump back from that. But the Democratic members of Congress have been the fiercest on this, particularly the representatives from Nevada, where thousands of people are still suffering from the radioactive poisoning of the tests we conducted over these years. So you saw Representative Dina Titus of Nevada vow absolutely not, and she has introduced a bill to prevent the resumption of nuclear testing. You saw Nevada's Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen says that this claim directly contradicts promises she got from Trump nominees who are now heading up the DOE and the National Nuclear Security Agency that will conduct the tests. They vow that they did not see a need for nuclear testing, and that she also would back a bill in the Senate to prevent the resumption. And of course, the National Weapon Laboratories, Los Alamos, where you work, Lawrence Livermore, Sandia, every year the director of those national laboratories certify to Congress that our nuclear weapons are safe, reliable, and effective, and we do not need to conduct nuclear testing. So I think there's going to be formidable opposition to that. It'll be a fight if he's really serious about this. We have to hope that this was all typical Donald Trump bluster, and by next week he'll forget he even said any of this.
Well, he'll come up with something just as bad, if not worse.
So
don't think we're out of the woods here. But just in closing, though, it does seem that he is losing it, because there's nothing more serious than nuclear weapons, frankly. And by the way, when he did his first briefing after the so-called 2016 victory in Trump Tower before his inauguration, one of the first briefings he had, all he wanted to talk about was what would happen if a nuclear weapon hit Manhattan. So he's got something of an obsession about nuclear weapons. And I find it extraordinary, Joe, to think that we have a president whose mental fitness is extremely questionable, and yet the people that are sitting in those silos in the prairies with the Minuteman missiles at their fingertips, they are waiting for an order from a president who could well be mentally impaired. Meanwhile, the launch officers in the Strategic Air Command, they have to go through rigorous psychological testing, not just once, but every year, to make sure they're not insane enough to launch a nuclear weapon. Yet the guy that gives the order to launch a nuclear weapon doesn't have to be tested for his sanity.
That's an excellent point, Ian. You're exactly right. I am convinced that the president is mentally impaired, that something is wrong with him, and he's getting worse. So it's not just the lies. It's his, he believes the lies. He cannot distinguish between fantasy and reality. He thinks what he says is true, in part because he just says it. If you saw the film, A House of Dynamite, and I loved the movie, I strongly recommend it, you could see that in that movie, when confronted with an incoming nuclear missile and they have to try to figure out what the response is going to be, you have a president who's anguishing over the choices. You have a deeply knowledgeable Secretary of Defense. You have a Deputy National Security Advisor who, though young, understands the issues, has facts at his fingertips. And they still are facing a nightmare world. Even with the best leadership, these are extremely difficult decisions. But in the real world, we have President Trump. We have Pete Hegseth. We have Marco Rubio. I wouldn't trust these people to watch my dog, let alone preside over the nuclear weapons arsenal of the United States, something that could destroy all of humanity in an afternoon. No, we are in a deep, deep national security crisis with President Trump and the completely incompetent leadership team that he's assembled. Real life, it turns out, is more frightening than the fictional realities shown to us by Hollywood.
Well, Joseph Cerincione, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Cerincione, who's the Vice Chair of the Board of the Center for International Policy and a nuclear security analyst and author with over 35 years of experience working in Washington, D.C. He's the author or editor of 7 books, including Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late, and Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously served as the president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation, and was director for nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And he's also worked for over 9 years on the professional staff of the Armed Services Committee and the Government Operations Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives, and writes a Substack page, Strategy and History, where his latest article is Donald Trump's Deep Nuclear Confusion. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the top priority for dictators is to close down their legislatures. But Trump needs no Reichstag fire since he has Speaker Mike Johnson closing down the Congress for him with the House of Representatives that has only convened for 12 days in the last 3 months and appears ready to shut down indefinitely. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Will Bunch, a national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the author of several books, including The Byrne Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. He's won numerous journalism awards and shared the Pulitzer Prize for Spot News Reporting with the New York Newsday staff. And these latest articles at the Philadelphia Inquirer are How an Ice Shakeup Will Bring Chicago-Level Terror to Philadelphia, and It Didn't Take a Reichstag Fire to Burn Down Congress. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Bunch.
Yeah, hi, Ian. Thanks for having me back.
Well, thanks for joining us. And a lot of people actually sent me your article, It Didn't Take a Reichstag Fire to Burn Down Congress. So it's clearly getting a lot of attention. But let's just touch on the other article on how the ice shakeup will bring Chicago level terror to Philly. We're learning more about what's going on with ICE, and it's being replaced in many ways by the Border Patrol, Customs and Border Patrol, because apparently the sort of co-president, if you will, Stephen Miller, has set a quota of 3,000 people are supposed to be rounded up every day. Mm-hmm. And apparently I think that they're doing about 1,700 per day. And Miller is furious. And he basically runs DHS, which is in turn run by Corey Lewandowski, who's having an affair with the ICE Barbie in charge, but she's not really in charge, Kristi Noem. So this is extraordinary what they're doing. And one of the things I just learned, which is really frightening, is Trump has given ICE access to the Israeli spyware Pegasus.
Right.
Which means...
Yeah, I have seen that.
Yeah, that they can, they're using Pegasus as well as Palantir to round up people and identify them and create...
And I believe they're doing a lot with facial recognition. Maybe that's related to the... Doing a lot of facial recognition type stuff to try and figure out who, in their warped view, is somebody who's deportable, so...
Right, but they're getting it all wrong.
Yeah.
This is the part of it that I don't understand. And one of the fears about Pegasus is that ICE could use Pegasus to go after their critics, people like you and me, because all I, with Pegasus, since you don't know, your own iPhone becomes a weapon against you. They could plant child pornography on my iPhone and have me arrested. That's the kind of...
Or they could spy on our conversations, because obviously a lot of people just texting a family member, whatever, said, oh, these ICE raids are despicable or whatever, you know, and they could use that against you. You know, I mean, there have already been several cases now where they've indicted protesters who, frankly, you know, didn't really majorly cross lines, but they claimed that they did. It happened in Spokane, Washington, and then much more higher profile, it happened this week in Chicago, and the congressional candidate who's gotten a lot of attention there, Kat Abigazala, who was a social media influencer who's now running for Congress, but is raising a lot of money and raising her profile, and she was just indicted, and, you know, she was with a group of protesters, and yeah, I mean, they had some interest in, you know, blocking or slowing, you know, the vehicles leaving this ICE facility. And they've got a picture of her, with her hand on a vehicle. And as a result, she's been indicted on federal felony charges. So they are already going after protesters. And that's without using tools like this. And these tools, you know, they make a lot of mistakes. I was reading an article this week where
in some cases, their, you know, whatever facial recognition or whatever they're using on people says somebody's not a citizen, and they'll say, well, no, I've got my, you know, U.S. passport or some other documentation proving their citizenship on them physically. And the ICE people will say, well, no, we don't believe that. We believe our software. We believe, you know, whatever. So you're going to see a lot more, I think, of these arrests of U.S. citizens. I mean, ProPublica has documented 170 of these, and that's probably just the tip of the iceberg, you know. So, things are going off the rails. You know, since we're talking, you mentioned the piece about at the beginning of the conversation about what's going on with this ICE shakeup. And it's kind of interesting. It's like, I don't want to say ICE are the good guys, but it turns out that, like, ICE within the Homeland Security world, they're seen as more of the by the book, we do investigations, we actually do try and target criminals. That's what we do. At least a lot of the rank and file see it that way. Whereas the Border Patrol, and I did an interview for this column with Jen Budd, the former Border Patrol agent who became a whistleblower, and their tactics are honed at the border, which is the wild, wild west. And they're, you know, chasing people through the desert, throwing people to the ground out there. And now they're bringing these tactics to cities like Chicago and Los Angeles and maybe Philadelphia, which is one of the cities where they're putting one of their new people in, is next. Almost all of these ICE field office directors who were ousted last week have been replaced with people from the Border Patrol, because that's what they want. If you've been paying attention to Chicago, you've probably seen this guy, Greg Bovino, who's running the operation out there. He's a real cowboy within the Border Patrol world. And they want to replicate that in every major city that has a large Latino population.
Well, the recruitment videos for the DHS put out for ICE and for CPB say that we're hiring you to protect our borders and protect our culture. Now, what in God's name does that mean, Will? That's such a racist dog whistle.
And yeah, I mean, clearly they're modeling these recruitment tactics after, I mean, it's just, I never thought I would see such a thing in my lifetime, but they're modeling after what happened in Germany in 1930s. And they're obviously, like you said, they're trying to recruit a certain kind of person, right? You know, a person who has these retrograde views about race and preserving the white culture, and that's what they're going for. It's horrifying.
And is this all coming from the co-president, his mindset? Because he's obviously a man with hate. But the other president is bad enough, isn't he?
Yeah, well, the other president, I don't know. The other president seems to be flitting in and out of reality. And he's preoccupied with building this ballroom next to the White House. And apparently he just put in a marble bathroom next to the Lincoln bedroom, and he's swapping out the toilets and all of that. So he seems more preoccupied by that. And he's happy to let, like you said, his co-president, Stephen Miller, handle the details. And he's just a fanatic, you know. He's a Himmler type figure in this regime, you know, that he's hardcore. If you remember back in the spring, which seems like 5 years ago, but Stephen Miller was the one who called in these ICE local directors and took them to task, you know, upbraided them because they weren't arresting enough people. And he's the one who's fixated on making this 3,000 arrests a day thing happen. And obviously, to the extent that a few of these people are hardened criminals, that's fine, I guess. But it's a very small percentage. And the more they do this, the more the percentage of people who have no criminal record, especially if, like me, you don't really consider crossing the border to be a crime, have no other criminal record for sure, that those percentage of people go up, because that's the only way you're going to arrest 3,000 people a day. There just aren't that many people who, you know. And when they say crimes, you know, a lot of these are, you know, and I'm not defending drunk driving, it's bad, but, you know, a lot of these are like drunk driving cases from a dozen years ago, or or less, you know, some kind of weird traffic violation, somebody got into a bar fight, which, you know, again, is not the best behavior in the world, but we're turning people's lives upside down over these things that happened in many cases a long time ago. But that's how you get 3,000 arrests a day.
Well, but it's not how you get 3,000 arrests a day, because they're arresting people for nothing, aren't they? I mean,
that's, if what I said was confusing, let me just clarify. I mean, the bulk of these people are like day laborers or Uber drivers or, you know, people who do kind of essential jobs in this society going about their business. And like you said accurately, they are not arresting 3,000 people a day yet. In fact, I think you said 1,700. I've seen some numbers that I think it peaked at that. I think it's even dipped a little lower instead of going up. So that's why you see all these, Congress authorized them, unfortunately, to hire 10,000 new agents. And so that's why you're seeing all these recruitment ads. And that's now why, that's the reason why you're seeing these Border Patrol guys being put in Philadelphia and Phoenix and San Diego and these other cities. Because it's all with the goal of going out to Home Depots and going to restaurants and going to farms and arresting everybody and getting up to 3,000 arrests a day, and it's a humanitarian nightmare.
So let's talk about your Reichstag Fire article, because the point you make is that dictators, their first priority is to shut down their legislatures, and in Hitler's case, in February of 27, 1933, less than a month after Hitler was named chancellor, there was a fire that destroyed the nation's legislative building, the Reichstag. It was blamed on a Dutch communist. And Hitler used that excuse to issue and implement the Reichstag Fire Decree, which meant that he expelled all the leftist lawmakers who all ended up in the newly created concentration camps. And then the only people that were left in the parliament were Hitler's people, the Nazis.
And they passed the Enabling Act, which codified Hitler's dictatorial powers. So it was a two-step. You had the decree, you got rid of the legislators, and then you passed the law, and now it was, quote, legal, unquote, for Hitler to be a dictator. So,
right. Yeah. But now in the United States, thanks to little Mikey Johnson's fealty to Donald Trump, you don't even have to have a Reichstag fire. Our legislature is already shut down.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the point I wanted to make, because, at some point, they had a summer recess. They were waiting to see what the Senate was going to do on this shutdown, maybe extended a week or whatever. But at this point, I believe that the House has met 3 days, I think, in the last 3 months, or maybe it's a little bit more. It might be 12 days, just a handful of days in the last 3 months. And right now, there's no, in fact, I think I just heard, next week is officially canceled again, and it's happening again and again. And if you don't have a House, you don't have a Congress. I mean, Congress and the House of Representatives specifically was really the whole centerpiece of this whole democratic project that the founders in 1789, when they wrote up the Constitution, was the way they envisioned it. And you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure this out, or a political scientist. Just look at the Constitution. Article 1, the first part, is about Congress and the powers of Congress. And the powers of the president come after that, Article 2. Congress was supposed to be the leader of our democracy, and now they're not even meeting. And one reason why I wrote the piece was because this whole shutdown of the House has been, what's the word I want to use? I want to say conflated, but I don't know if that's the right word. But it's overlapped with another issue, which is preventing a vote on the opening the Epstein files, the Jeffrey Epstein files that supposedly have Donald Trump's name in it, that would chronicle, this financier with all these ties to Trump and other wealthy people who died under mysterious circumstances while he was awaiting sex crime trials. Probably a lot of your listeners know that they have 217 signatures on the discharge petition to force a vote, and they had a special election in Arizona, and Gujarala, the 218th congressperson, is ready to come in and sign it and force that vote. And so as a result, Mike Johnson keeps coming up with excuses not to swear in, and he's using the shutdown as an excuse to not swear in. And people are very focused on that, and I do think it's horrible. But I think the shutdown of the House and the shutdown of Congress is much bigger than that. I think because it's letting Trump rule by decree in all these different ways, you know, deciding that he's going to pay the troops during this shutdown, but not do food stamps. I mean, he's already becoming a dictator in terms of trying to rule the country by executive orders and by these decisions. You know, he's blowing up boats and murdering people in the Caribbean without any congressional oversight and certainly without a declaration of war. So we need to take a step back. I mean, Congress has almost disappeared, and we don't know when they're coming back, or we don't know if they're coming back at this point.
Well, they've only met for 12 days over the last 3 months. And it looks like the government shutdown has been a gift to both Trump and Mike Johnson, because they'll just shut it down indefinitely, which indicates that Mike Johnson and his colleagues, his Republican colleagues, have simply given up and abdicated.
What was Congress doing before this? I mean, how many bills, you know, I think Trump's position was he needed them to pass one bill, you know, his big, beautiful bill. And once they passed that, he was done with them. And he'd rather rule without them because he doesn't need their help anymore. And all they can do is annoy him with stuff like the Epstein files or asking questions about the boats or other things that they want to investigate. So,
But they don't want to investigate.
They meant the Democrats. I should have been more specific about that. But when the House is in session, there are more opportunities for the Democrats to be heard on some of these issues. And, you know, by shutting them down and shutting down the Capitol, or shutting down that section of the Capitol anyway, he's not only shutting down the Epstein investigation. He's shutting down so much more.
Right. So it's fair to say then that Mike Johnson, the good Christian from Louisiana, is basically protecting pedophiles.
Yeah, I do think it's fair to say. Although, Mike Johnson reminds me of that skit on Saturday Night Live, the unfrozen caveman lawyer who, you know, spent thousands of years frozen in a cave and doesn't know anything. And Johnson claims ignorance about basically everything that's happening in this country, including Epstein. So, you know, he's somebody who came out of nowhere to be the speaker. And I think he's thrilled that he has the title and thrilled that he has the prestige of that office. And he doesn't care about defending the power of Congress. You know, just quickly, I mean, it used to be a lot different. You know, if you go back to the 70s, people in Congress were very defensive of the institution, regardless of their party. You know, you had a 99-0 vote in the Senate to have a Watergate investigation. You know, you passed legislation like the War Powers Act, in which Congress supposedly has the ability to restrain the president's ability to make these wars like the one he's doing in the Caribbean, but they're not using it. But they're not using it because Mike Johnson and the leader and the Republicans in Congress don't care.
So just in closing then, Will Bunch, do you think that the Democrats should run on, obviously there's a lot of reasons why they should up their game, but maybe one of their arguments should be that vote for us and we'll have a Congress again.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the numbers are there, right? You know, as we're saying, you know, to only meet for a few days. I mean, all you have to do is tell the voters, you know, look, Congress just took, you know, 8 weeks in a row off. You know, wouldn't you like to have 8 weeks in a row off? The thing is, I mean, people are mad about the things that you'd expect them to be mad about, right? They're mad about how much groceries or how much when you go out to eat, how much it costs. They're starting to get their insurance, health insurance bills for next year, and they're starting to get mad about that. Certainly some people are going to be mad about what's going on with the SNAP benefits, food assistance. But I think you don't necessarily have to run just on that. You can link that in to the other things. You can link that in to Congress not meeting. You can link that in to the ballroom and what Trump is up to. Show them that these abuses of power are also linked to them not doing anything to help you in your everyday life. I mean, it can be done. They should be doing it.
Well, Banchai, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Will Bunch, who's a national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the author of a number of books, including The Byrne Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. He's won numerous journalism awards, including the Pulitzer Prize. His latest articles at the Philadelphia Inquirer are How an Ice Shakeup Will Bring Chicago-Level Terror to Philly and It Didn't Take a Reichstag Fire to Burn Down Congress. We can take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a feminist journalist banned from working around by the Ministry of Intelligence, whose latest book released on the 3-year anniversary of the Women Life Freedom Movement in Iran documents the demonstrations following the death of Mahsa Jina Amini at the hands of the morality police in Tehran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Fatima Jamalpour, a feminist journalist banned from working in Iran by the Ministry of Intelligence. Jamalpour has worked as a freelance reporter for outlets such as the Sunday Times, the Paris Review, and the Los Angeles Times, and has also held positions at the BBC World News in London and at the Shag newspaper in Tehran. And she has 2 master's degrees in journalism and communications from Northwestern University and the Amale Tabatabi by University in Tehran, and was a 2024-2025 Knight Wallace Fellow at the University of Michigan. And she is the co-author of the new book just out, For the Sun After Long Night. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fatima Jamalpour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you participated in the demonstration against the clerical kleptocracy in Iran. And just a week ago, on September the 16th, that marked the 3rd anniversary of the Women Life Freedom Movement's demonstrations, which you participated in. So from your point of view, it's got to be deeply disappointing that all of those sacrifices and the bravery that the women showed has, well, let me ask you, what has it led to? You still have this oppressive government that seems more and more isolated from the world than ever. And is there any, as the old expression going back to the Vietnam War, is there any light at the end of the tunnel here in terms of freedom for the Indian people?
As we name our book For the Sun After a Long Night, I see many hopes. So these days, 3 years after killing of Mahsa Jina Amini, a 32-year-old young woman killed by morality police in Iran, the number of women and young girls who walk out in public without hijab is millions. I saw a video of the young woman in a sport bra running in religious city in Mashhad. You know, I think we women made Islamic Republic impossible to impose hijab rules on us anymore, you know? And it's a revolution and huge victory. After 4 decades of fighting with mandatory hijab, Iranian women take control of their bodies and their agencies back. So I consider it as, you know, victory. And also, I see the changes and effect of this movement in our society. Like my father, my brother, you know, all of these Iranian men now supporting women. And, you know, the number of the honor killing has decreasing. It shows that our society moving towards secularism and feminism. And I think these changes and effects are from Iran and long lasting. Doesn't matter who ruling now.
But do you think, though, that with the aging supreme leader, whose son Mujtaba Khamenei is, you know, he runs a big bank, he's with the Revolutionary Guard Corps, he's high up in that. There's some rumors that he's trying to become the next supreme leader. Yeah. And, you know, he doesn't have any religious qualifications, not that his father necessarily has them either. So is there a possibility that the secession after Khamenei dies will bring about change, or could it possibly be the end of this kleptocratic clerical mafia?
Sure. So I want to clarify something. Like, nowadays 80% of Iranian population are against regime, according to a statistic of, you know, the Academian Inside Iran. So regime has no legitimacy among people. And we saw in each protest people shouting in the street that Mujtaba, you will die, addressing the son of the supreme leader, and you will not see being supreme leader. You know, people are saying that, no, they will not tolerate this anymore. And I think our country now is just like being hostage by the IRGC and the supreme leader. It's totally a failure state, you know, in any aspect, like education, like providing health care, you know, providing electricity, providing drinking water. We have many, many, many crises there. And I think Iranian society is like, you know, the ash which waiting to be, you know, explode another time. We don't know when the next protest will happen, in next 2 months or next 2 years. But I don't think that this regime could stay in power and the succession will happen again. So we know that if Khamenei will die, people will go to the street to celebrate it. And I don't think that the IRGC or any riot police would force them to return back.
Well, it's obviously the government that's been around since the revolution,
yep,
going back to Ayatollah Khamenei, is suffered enormous setbacks. Its main project, which has apparently always been pretty unpopular with the average Iranian, the extent to which they've been spending money on Hamas and Hezbollah and all of their regional ambitions and the idea of the Quds Force of Jerusalem, liberating Jerusalem in the name of the Iranian Revolution, has been a very costly project. But recently, obviously, it's been pretty much rolled back, where they've suffered tremendous blows and their support of Hamas is obviously diminished because the leader of Hamas was killed by the Israelis in Tehran, which definitely undermines their credibility. Hezbollah is a defeated force now. And there was, of course, a brief war with Israel, which the U.S. joined in and dropped a couple of bombs on the nuclear facilities. Trump claims that it was a great victory. I'm not sure that is true, and I suspect that they do have plenty of that fissile material to make bombs, whether that will be a step they will take or not. But in general, what's the feeling in Iran after all of these setbacks and all of these decades of prioritizing their foreign policy at the expense of the lives of the average Iranians?
Yeah, sure. So the majority of Iranians are not angry with all of this, you know, investment that the regime did for militia group in the region, like, you know, funding Hezbollah, funding Hamas, funding Hashad al-Shaabi in Yemen. They spend million and million, and also they waste many money for Atomic energy with people, you know, just saying we don't want that much costly atomic energy. Iran, the majority of Iranian people are not supporting any of this foreign policy anymore, you know. And we're hearing in the protests that people shouting, our enemy is not the US, is the regime. It was a slogan. So people distancing themselves, you know, with this foreign policy. And during the wartime, majority of people didn't support bombing and war. You know, we don't believe that bombing will bring freedom for us. Like what we saw that in Afghanistan, what we saw in, you know, what happened in Iraq. It shows that the war will not bring freedom and democracy, for sure. But they blame the regime and supreme leader to bring the country for the second time during this regime to the war, you know? It was their responsibility, it was their fault. They made the Israel have execution to bombing our countries.
So, just to turn back to your book, For the Sun After Long Nights, it's an interesting and unusual collaboration. You were there demonstrating with the women 3 years ago in the Women, Life, Freedom movement. And at the same time, through encrypted app, you were communicating with the co-author, Nilo Tabrizi, who's an investigative reporter with the Washington Post. So, first of all, tell us about how you joined in the movement. What was the precipitating moment? Obviously, you were joining in with a lot of people, but just describe that moment of when you made that choice to face the possibility of being, you know, beaten up or even killed by the religious police and the Pasdaran and the other government vigilantes. I'm trying to think of a way to describe them.
Sure. So 6 months before the movement interrupted in Iran, I was a journalist working at BBC. And I know as a BBC journalist, I could not return back to Iran because the regime considered, you know, diaspora media as enemy and mercenary. But my family told me that my father got cancer and I had to decide between journalism and my family. I chose my family, I returned back to Iran. And I got arrested in the airport. Many forces from the Ministry of Intelligence were waiting for me with gun and camera. You know, it was a really shocking moment because I consider myself as just a simple journalist, but they consider me as a real criminal. Then I went through 16 interrogation sessions, and at the end they told me that they're going to send me to prison for 5 years. And it was exactly 3 days after the movement happened in Iran. So when I left the interrogation session, I know that I may go to the prison for 5 years. And I thought that I'm going to do something meaningful for myself and my people. So I decided to reporting on the protest day by day. Even I got shot, but I continue reporting, you know. Yeah, it was my turning point, knowing that I have nothing to lose except my life.
Well, we've run out of time, Fatima, but I thank you so much for joining us here today and for sharing your story and your new book, For the Sun After Long Nights.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope people will read our book and it will bring awareness and empathy.
And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon, Sasha Linden-Cohen, and Asha Price. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easier for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and we highly encourage your ratings and reviews on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook, as well as also now on Blue Sky at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing the program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. And I'm always available at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now.
AM, heard globally at kpfk.org. I'm going to go to the hospital.